All right, Mackenzie, it's November.
No.
No? We're not calling it that?
I mean, I guess that could work.
I feel like because we did Tarantino-vember, so I thought, like, let's try and play out the director's
name. I just feel like
name.
It doesn't have enough of his name, but, you know, that's fine. We can make that
well,
work.
Well, we got 4 more weeks to work on it, so.
We'll chop each week, see what the people say. By yes, the end, we'll have it finalized.
In case it wasn't clear from my incredible pun, this is Steven Spielberg month, and we're starting with a banger today with Jurassic Park. So I'm going to ask you what I think is a fairly predictable cold open question for this one. So what is your favorite dinosaur? Wait for it. Fan fiction.
No.
Not going there? Not a big...
No, I have no favorite dinosaur fanfic. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Well, let me list a few of my favorites, just so the people out there, you know, have some reading material for after we finish up. So I think the classiest one that I've read is called My Jurassic Affair. Really wow. High quality, good prose, just very enthralling throughout. But I'm also a big fan of the Ravaged by Raptors series. I think my favorite in that was A Pterodactyl's Touch. And I like that in the title, they actually do the PT for pterodactyl and touch. I think that's pretty symbolic, very deep. But if you want like the lowbrow stuff, I think Brachiosaurus is probably where you want to go. If like, that's like high school level shit. I don't really associate with that, but yeah.
Is anyone else concerned for Lamar's reading material? Like
everybody needs a hobby.
No. That's a hobby. That's a choice. That's a choice for sure. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we have a guest.
Woo!
Hello.
Matt is joining us. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me. This is an exciting experience.
It's. I feel like I heard a rumor that you sort of bullied your way onto the pod. Do you want to give us a quick background of how this happened?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Mackenzie. So Matt is my best friend. We've known each other for over 20 years now. Very cool guy, but he had a lot to say about the Jaws episode. You want to take it from there, buddy?
That's true. I did have a lot to say, and I did bully. There's no wrong way
about
it. If
y'all listened to the fan 1 year ep, it was definitely Matt's comment about the Jaws episode. So,
well, I'm glad that you did this film for 4th of July. It's a lot of fun watching and listening along. But yeah, it's one of my favorite films, and I would have loved an invite. I like talking about this movie, so, you know, I listened to it and was giving all sorts of little critiques and notes, and I said, hey, get me on here sometime.
Little critiques, little notes.
I don't want to repeat our defense of ourselves, because I think we covered it pretty well during the 1 year, but that... Technically, that was a tough episode to make happen, but Jurassic Park is what your next favorite movie, or are they just interchangeable? One and two?
I was going to say, did you just like, what made you bully your way on for Jurassic Park? Like, why was this the next choice?
Jurassic Park is number one. Jaws is 1A. They're 1A. They're like this.
Well, we know that which one is two, really, because it has an A after it. So that's, you can call it whatever you want, but because it has an A, it's technically two.
Sure.
Okay. Well, technically number two is what we're kicking off a whole new month with. If you guys haven't gleaned that yet, we are starting a whole new month here on the pod featuring our legendary and most storied and one of the most storied and successful filmmakers of all time, Mr. Steven Spielberg. And I try not to call every single one of his films a classic. It's really hard not to because they're usually very, very good. But this one is certainly, I think, a 90s classic with Jurassic Park. So we're going to get into Matt's number one. Okay. Number one. Got it.
But you even get a little bit of Jaws in this one. It's playing in like the control room. So you get to see your other favorite movie in this movie.
They're both Spielberg films, right? Yeah. So, I mean.
Is that like self-aggrandizing of Mr. Spielberg?
Should we call him out now? Remember how awesome this one was? He should have done that in all his movies. It's like what Pixar does with the back referencing and stuff.
Oh, whole Spielberg cinematic universe. Yes. I'm in.
That's going to be an interesting connection of dots for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, before we get into all the deets of this one, which there is a lot to say, as I'm sure you guys can imagine, what are we drinking? So Lamar named this one, obviously didn't create it because he's got some feelings about it, but he did name it. What are we drinking?
Yeah, you guys know I didn't make this because there's Aperol in it, which Skylar is fully aware of. I feel it, you either love it or you don't, and I feel like it overpowers, but I'm outvoted here. Two of the three of us love this drink, and it's 1.5 ounces of tequila, 0.75 ounces of Aperol, 0.5 each of lemon, lime, and strawberry puree, and then a little extra simple to sweeten it up. And we are calling this Tyrannosaurus Rect, and then the backup name, if you don't like that one, is Dino DNA. So
I don't think you have to say the backup. It's not as good. Tyrannosaurus Rect is
Dino DNA is one of those things when you bring up Jurassic Park that at least in my circle of friends gets quoted all the time. Just like, boom, Dino DNA. So that one has stuck with me personally.
So you double named it. Okay. It's very delicious, I think, personally, but I love Aperol. So, Matt, what's your review of the cocktail?
It's really good. I'm not a tequila drinker or an Aperol drinker, but I think those other fruits really balance it out a little bit.
I was going to say, he poured some puree in there for you, Lamar. Like, the strawberry puree is all for you, just to sweeten that shit up.
I appreciate my comfort blanket being wrapped around my shoulders by Skylar as I drink this.
Oh, all right. Well, cheers, y'all. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so before we get into all this, I wanted to ask y'all a very critical question. I think you can guess what it is, but I think it's important. What is your favorite dinosaur?
Well, what? Favorite herbivore? We got like different kinds here. Yeah, best dinosaur, favorite dinosaur is Parasaurolophus. That's the hadrosaur, the duck-billed dinosaur with the little crest. He's got the skull.
Oh my God, I love that you have it ready. All right, center that baby. We need to see it. Oh, there it is.
He brought his own props.
He brought his own props. That is very prepared. That is next level. I love it. Lamar, what's yours?
I'm just
no fanfic entries. It has to be a real dinosaur.
I've spoken at length about my fanfiction, so I'm gonna go the easy way and say Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't have all these fancy scientific terms, so I have the top five dinosaurs to choose from, basically Land Before Timing It. And ever since I saw that, I thought, man, that T-Rex, he's got it going on. He's pretty awesome. So,
I mean, he's pretty cool. But the coolest dinosaur, in case y'all wanted to know, is actually Thesaurus.
Is that a real? Oh, he learned to read. Good for him.
Thesaurus, and he knows all the words. Thesaurus knows all the words. If y'all thought I wasn't going to like make a pun out of this, then y'all were wrong. Y'all didn't anticipate the full nerddom today. I got a t-shirt. We have props from Matt. I think
I'm here.
Lamar is here with the basic T-Rex answer. Yeah. I expected more. I expected more.
I really like this movie. So,
well, I do love Thesaurus, but I will say my favorite is Brachiosaurus. So, like, for real, for real. Well, now that we know everybody's favorite dinosaur, which is important information going into this discussion, obviously, we're going to chat some basics. And for those of you who maybe, for some crazy reason, have never seen Jurassic Park, this will not be spoiler-free today.
We are
going in hard. So, as you guys know, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time. So we're doing Jurassic Park, 1993. There's been several, so I do think that's an important note. This is the OG. And the ratings here are pretty solid, as I think one would expect. So 8.2 out of 10 on IMDb. And Rotten Tomatoes is tied at 91% for both critics and audiences alike. So that's a rarity.
I wonder what those 9% of people were finding wrong with the film. What did they not like?
Those are the science nerds who were like annoyed. I guarantee you. They were like, this is not possible. My ex-husband was one of these people. He would have been like tearing it down, you know, the whole time, 100%. But it's okay to be wrong. It happens. It happens. Well, obviously the director we've covered, Mr. Steven Spielberg, I think it's really difficult to accurately represent his movie resume. So I'm just going to share a couple each week since we're going to be doing this for a month.
Smart.
So I'll start with E.T., obviously, very famous film of his, and Schindler's List, two wildly different films, but that I think, again, show some filmmaking expertise and range on Mr. Spielberg's part. And we'll hit a few more down the road.
Schindler's List
came out
the same year as this, right, as Jurassic Park? We were like back to back.
It was very close. It was either the same year or right. Yeah, right back to back.
He actually wrapped up production on Jurassic Park 2 weeks ahead of schedule so he could go to Poland and start filming Schindler's List. That's how quick the turnaround was. And then post-production, he was in Poland taking video conference calls in the early 90s to get this film finished, which is insane.
Yeah, like video conference calls in the early 90s. Yeah, you're right. That is super insane. Super insane. No, and he had just done Hook right before this too. So he was just like blowing and going, my guy.
I think I read that he was up against himself in some Oscar categories because of Schindler's List and this coming out the same year. So that's kind of fun.
I mean, you're increasing your odds. Great work.
Unless you're splitting votes if you got a bunch of friends in the Academy. We know that it's not a perfect system.
Yeah, it's very, you know, but I guess that was his strategy. Like, I got to win somehow. If I have the more entries I have, the more probability I have of winning, I guess was his thought. So way to go, Spielberg. Well, this was written by a handful of people, to be honest. So the source material is obviously the book. And that is a series, by the way, if you didn't know, but Michael Crichton. And he's done a few things that you probably know, obviously Jurassic Park, but definitely Westworld, Twisters, Rising Sun. He often does the adaptations, or at least contributes to the adaptations of his books as well. So the same thing happened here, where he was paid an additional, on top of the rights, paid an additional $500K to adapt it. And they actually didn't even use his final version, which is where David Koepp comes in. He wrote Angels and Demons, War of the Worlds, Spider-Man, Secret Window, Death Becomes Her, which is actually one of the reasons he was hired, Mission Impossible, the first one, which was a surprising one for me, and Snake Eyes, one of my like dark horse favorite ones that I think is fun, interesting. So he's got range as well. Like, he's written a lot of things.
Yeah, he's one that I wanted to touch on just because it was a name that I'm not super familiar with. Like, I've probably seen it in so many credits over the course of my life. And apparently he was inspired to write movies in the first place because he saw the Indiana Jones scene where the guy's like got the whip and then Indy pulls out the gun. And that's what caused him to even want to be a writer in Hollywood. So Spielberg himself inspired this guy, and they ended up going on to write like half a dozen to a dozen films together. And like, super impressive. You named about 10 of them. And some of those he wrote and directed. He did Stir of Echoes, which was a favorite of mine back in the day. Kind of spooky. Same with Secret Window. And he also did, Matt, what's your favorite movie about bicycle messengers?
Oh, Premium Rush.
That is a David Koepp film. So
great
there you go.
Film. Great, great film. Michael Shannon, Jogolevs.
Jogolevs.
Between the two of them, Cope and Crichton, being able to write so many different sci-fi thrillers and getting them adapted on screen, Congo, Sphere, just a lot of great films in a unusual genre at that time.
Yeah.
I was so you actually say... like sci-fi, unlike our boy Lamar.
Totally.
Here, is
totally.
What I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Bless you. Now I can call you when we want to do sci-fi and he doesn't want to do it. So you and I can bully him and get him to do it.
That's not, I'm not, I don't take well to bullying. It just chases
I accept
me
your
further
invitation.
Away.
Except Matt's here. So clearly it worked. Clearly it worked.
Shit. My life is a lie. I did want to point out, though, that with Crichton, I'm going to say a couple times today, this movie, the reason why I think it's damn near perfect is because they make the most, they have incredible subject matter to start with. Like, okay, we have a movie about dinosaurs. It's at this time where we have the effects to make this happen, and they do not waste a minute of it. They make this perfect film using the subject matter. But just speaking to that, like, Crichton was paid $2 million up front just for the rights to this before he'd even finished the book. They didn't even know what the book, like what it was all going to be. They just said, oh, a dinosaur book by Crichton? Yes, please. We'd like to make that into a movie. Go ahead, go write it. And that is just bonkers and speaks to his reputation, but also just where they saw this going.
Yeah, he finished it like right as Spielberg was finishing Hook. So it was like, again, bam, bam, and it was ready. But again, they did some rewrites on it. So I think it's fair to say it was a team effort from a writing perspective. They also do a lot of things to trim the content because the book was so long and there is so much exposition in the book. So one of them...
Have you both read the book?
I have not read the book, actually. Yeah, yeah, so Matt, you have.
Yeah, I think I probably read it just a couple years after seeing the film for the first time. And there's a lot of scenes and moments in the book that they end up using in one aspect or another in the rest of the franchise.
Yes. They do that in Jurassic World. They do it in Dominion, I think it was. Like, they have various shots that they've adapted into other ones because it was too much for this one.
Right. There's a river scene, which was incredible in the novel. And I think they bring it back to some degree in the third film. And they made a number of changes from the books. But yeah, a couple scenes ended up making it later on, which is good because there's some pretty wild moments.
The river scene made it into the Sega Genesis game. So thank God for that.
It's a tough one. Yes.
It's a hard level.
Oh, I wouldn't know. I wasn't allowed to play video games. I'm lame. Sad day. Y'all can teach me now, though. So let's hit some major cast and crew. We'll try to go fast, as is not our forte, but we'll see if we can. Sam Neill plays Dr. Grant. He has done not a ton of things that people in the U.S. would probably recognize, being that he's only been in a couple of like major North American films, like Hunt for the Wilder People and The Piano, as far as distribution, as far as people seeing them here. And I don't know if y'all have seen Hunt for the Wilder People, but it's very good if you haven't seen it. It's very, very good film. What else? Anybody have any other favorites of Sam Neill?
Yes. Event Horizon.
Spooky as fuck.
Yeah.
He was also in, I didn't finish Peaky Blinders, but I know he's in at least the first season of that as like the bad guy. And he plays a really kind of conniving, crooked cop, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty damn good in
that. He is very good in that. You're right. I totally forgot about that. I didn't finish that either.
I guess that might be a British series too. That might not be an American series. So
it is, but it's on Netflix. So I'm more like, do you have access to it?
Netflix is an American citizen. We know.
Right, right.
If it's on there, that's an American series.
Sure, sure. Laura Dern is next up as Dr. Ellie Sattler. She is incroyable in this and also in everything that she does. So she's done a bunch of things. Wild, Blue Velvet, Marriage Story is a bit more recent.
Good in that.
Yeah, she was very good in that. She was also in Star Wars, which if you didn't know, she plays one of the admirals. She's also done a ton of TV. And one of her, I think, more recent but also really great pieces of television is Big Little Lies on HBO. Yeah. And then she also just did Palm Royale, which I haven't seen yet, but I've heard good things about. So lots of great Laura Dern work. Anybody, any favorites from her?
Marriage Story. She was really fucking good in Marriage Story as the lawyer. Like, I thought she was a hard ass. And that movie in general is great, but she was fantastic. Yeah.
The movie is great, but hard. Just warning y'all, like very hard watch, especially if you have been through a divorce. I'm just telling you, it's very traumatic. Jeff Goldblum. Bring in the levity as per usual, but this is, I think, one of his early iterations of that where, you know, his whole persona is not such a pop culture thing. This is one of, I think, one of the things that really cemented that for him as Dr. Malcolm. He is a chaotician and he's been in tons of stuff. Like, I'm sure we all have different things that he's been in. But as far as what he's maybe known for, he did Independence Day. He did The Fly. He was also in the Grand Budapest Hotel, which was really fun turn for him. And then he just did a show on Netflix that I actually really loved, but just got canceled, which is Chaos. And it's a very nerdy, modernized adaptation.
Does he play the same character?
He plays Zeus. Oh, he plays Zeus.
He's a chaotician or whatever in this. And maybe it's a very late stage sequel.
Close, but also spelled different. So no, it's Greek mythology. It's like a Greek mythology modern tale. And he plays Zeus, who's like, you know, an egomaniac and very manipulative and all these things. He does great at it, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I would have watched five more seasons of this guy being Zeus, but apparently I was overruled. Any other favorite Jeff Goldblum moments?
Thor Ragnarok comes to mind. I liked his role as a Grandmaster.
That is a good one. That is a good one. I totally forgot about that, actually.
He seems to just, like, get around sexually and in work, you know? Like, he just... He seems very, like, he was on Tim and Eric back in that. He does that awkward comedy. He just seems open to everything in Hollywood. And I like that you never really know if he's playing himself or a version of himself.
He's a slut for TV and film work, yeah, is what we're saying. Yeah, he'll do anything you put in front of him, for sure.
And this is what, like 7 years before Wes Anderson hits the scene? More than that? 9 years? That's, and then he sort of falls into, like, I'm going to be in every Wes Anderson movie. Yeah.
Which is very fitting, if you ask me. Like, it's such a natural marriage of collaborators, I think, definitely. Richard Attenborough is also here, which I can never not think of David Attenborough when I hear this name, not just because of the name, but because, like, in this movie who he's playing, you know, and even they look kind of similar, it always fucks me up. But anyway, he plays Hammond, who is kind of a rewritten iteration of Hammond from the books, as I understand it, of, like, ruthless businessman to, like, old guy who's just a lover of nature and science and blah blah blah. And so he gives it a very different vibe. He gives it a very different energy. And he's been in a ton of TV, but he's not super prolific as a film actor. He did The Great Escape, though, and also Miracle on 34th Street. Any others that y'all thought of? Those are, like, the big ones that stood out to me. Yeah. I think he does a great job of being kind of a little bit crazy, a little bit single-minded here.
Well, he had, like, taken a 14-year break from acting starting in 79, and he came back for this specifically for the role. And at least, you know, me being born in 84, this is what I remember him as. Like, you mentioned the name, and this is the first role that comes to mind. So it's cool that he saw such potential there and came back in 93 for it.
100%. We also have, I did a couple smaller guys here. I'm going to kind of blow through them, but I think they're important to mention, which is Bob Peck, who plays Muldoon. He's done a lot of TV, like small TV, and then he also did Lord of the Flies, but he hasn't done a ton of other things. I think he does great.
It's mostly British cinema when I was looking at his list.
Yeah, a lot of British television. But
I didn't realize he died so young. He died in 99.
Yeah, only literally 6 years after this. Yeah, came out. That's crazy. We also have Martin Ferrero, who plays Gennaro, the lawyer, and he did Heat and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which I don't remember that, but he was in that as well. He doesn't have a very long appearance in this one, so he makes a mark, though.
That's what's interesting about the book changes, that Gennaro and Muldoon have huge roles in the novel, and they're badasses, and they're, like, wielding rocket launchers and blowing up dinosaurs. And
yeah, he's kind of a weenie in this. That's interesting.
Big pivot between the film and the novel.
That is a big pivot.
But he's still a lawyer in the novel? He's not really. Okay, okay.
But he, like, rises to the occasion, it sounds like. Okay. Yeah. Well, that would have been interesting, though. I don't know. I'm not sure which one I would have liked better. I feel you need
somebody
someone
to get
like him.
On the toilet. I feel right. Like that.
Yeah, you needed somebody. You need somebody like him for this shot, for sure. Like, that kind of character. I love it. Good background. I love being the person who hasn't read the book, by the way. Like, that's a new thing for me. Love this. BD Wong plays Wu. He's only in here for a split second, but he's helping birth a couple of the new dinosaurs from their eggs. And he's been in some fun stuff. Shows up in Jurassic World later, but he also is the voice of Shang in Mulan, if you didn't know. And he also did some, like, was an SVU for a long time. Like, who hasn't been on SVU, but he was on it for a long time. And then he's done a lot of other TV as well, but he's a good one. I like him. He's a fun appearance. We also have Joseph Mazzello, who plays Tim. He's the younger kid. He actually, like, they changed some things between the ages of the kids so that he could work with him. He had been auditioned for Hook, was a little too young, but Steven Spielberg wanted to work with him. So he did a little swap-a-rooney between the ages on Tim and Lex. He's been not in a ton of stuff. He did The River Wild kind of around this time as well, when he's still a kid. And then later on, he plays Dustin Moskovitz in The Social Network, which you may remember him as, like, the founder who just kind of stayed out of the drama, basically, of Facebook.
That's the one about the robot that betrays his friends and creates Facebook. Yeah.
Close enough. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Pretty close. Pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. He was also in Bohemian Rhapsody. He was one of the Queen guys, right?
Yes. Yes.
And then do you guys remember Radio Flyer? That I feel like that movie was so much darker than I knew it was when I was a kid. I was like, no, it's whimsical, but it's about, like, child abuse. It's kind of a dark film.
I do not remember that. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for the warning. Haven't seen it yet. Ariana Richards plays Lex. She's the hacker girl which is fun for me. I love seeing a computer nerd girl on the screen getting her time to shine. I will say the rest of the time she's kind of annoying, but you know, that part's cool. She also did Tremors, and then she was in a couple of the Jurassic Park series later on down the road and a little bit of TV, but she actually hasn't done a lot, really. And then the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Samuel L. Jackson, has a great turn in this. I think it's kind of small, but I think it's, as usual, very impactful when he's on the screen. He plays Arnold. He obviously has done a bazillion things. We've talked on the pod about him before. Pulp Fiction, Hateful Eight, some Marvel, was Nick Fury, tons and tons and tons of other stuff. But just a gem, as always.
Some, like, I forget what the actual, what my source is here, but there were this group of folks that did a study on the 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon game. And it was, yeah, because the question was, well, why play with Kevin Bacon? Because yes, he's in a lot of films, but he doesn't do as much as some other. And they did, they went and actually turned it into a science of who is it easiest to play that game with. And Sam Jackson was the number one result because he's done so many damn films. And not only that, but he's done such a variety of films between things like this, big blockbusters. He's in the Marvel series. He was in the Star Wars series. He's in Tarantino movies. So he just tends to work with everyone across the board and does a shit ton of material. So play 6 Degrees of Sam Jackson from now on, people.
Yeah, I feel like that's a much more impactful one. I mean, don't get me wrong, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon is fun. But yeah, I feel like this one could be more fun. And then I think I wanted to close it out with Mr. Wayne Knight as Dennis Nedry, which I think you kind of have to mention him. He's, again, small but impactful in his role. And he stands out to me, like, nostalgically as a kid, as one of the big characters. And it's interesting on rewatch where you're like, he's actually not on screen that much, but he has some shit that goes down for sure. He's done things like Dirty Dancing and Rat Race and like a lot more TV, honestly. Seinfeld. Yeah, Seinfeld, exactly. But yeah, he does this very well. Annoying, but well. Okay, last production note that I have to, well, not last production note, I have more production notes, but last cast, crew, major contributors, the music is done by one John fucking Williams, which that's his full name, in case you didn't know. It's just so fucking incredible. I have that, you know, again, I haven't watched it in a hot minute. And as I was watching, I was like, oh my God, the music. It's just, as usual, so good. I love that Spielberg and him partner so many times, but it's, yeah, it's just incredible. I think he does an incredible job.
I had a cassette tape of the soundtrack and played it over and over in my Walkman. My sister-in-law got married last year and she went down the aisle to the theme song. And when the piano started, I did the loudest audible gasp in the entire room.
That's like the hardest you've cried in your life at the wedding.
You're like verklempt over the music. I love it. Oh. That's incredible. What an entry song. Like, yeah. It's gorgeous, to be fair. But like, you would not expect that at a wedding. That's awesome. Okay, let's do a very quick plot summary. I think we all know what this is about, but I always like to gut check the plot summary, like if we feel like it's a good one or not, so may as well. An industrialist invites some experts to visit his theme park of cloned dinosaurs. After a power failure, the creatures run loose, putting everyone's lives, including his grandchildren's, in danger. Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, for everyone, though, at least it's a small group. That's why you do a cold open, friends and family weekend, because at least they're working out all the kinks with only like 10 people on the island instead of, you know, Jurassic World situation.
I love that Samuel Jackson's character is like, we have 151 items on the glitch list today. He's like, we have all the problems of a major theme park and a major zoo. And I remember like watching it before he says that and thinking that I'm like, this is a zoo and a theme park and combined. And it's, yeah, all the logistics that can go wrong are wild.
And nearly the entire staff leaves on a ship moments before they send the group out on the trial run.
Yeah, they're like, you know what? A storm's coming in. Like, you guys got this. I know it's our first dry run in a hot minute, but like, I'm going to catch that boat. They just peace out, motherfuckers. Like, it's wild to me. Otherwise we can't have this movie, I know, but like, holy shit. So weird.
I mean, I've worked at a Six Flags theme park. I know that things get swept under the rug and corners are cut. Just keep that in mind the next time you go to like Disney, or just look at the age of the ride attendants. Your safety is in the hands of 15-year-olds.
I know. So. I love when they're like, you're good to go. And I'm like, am I? Can you double check your tween giving me the clearance to not get my head chopped off? Yeah. Crazy, scary, scary, scary stuff. Well, speaking of production stuff, I did want to mention the budget here because holy shit balls. So this was a surprisingly low budget. I mean, it was a high budget, especially in the early 90s, but for what it made is pretty incredible. So $63 million for the budget, and they did a lot of things to trim to stay inside of that budget. But fun fact, it has grossed now over $1 billion, which sent me down a fucking rabbit hole. Because as you guys may recall, Titanic was like the first $1 billion film, and that's in 97. So I was like, what the fuck? So it actually has made 1.058 billion with a B. But in its original theatrical run, y'all, it made 914 million. Like, it was so close to kind of breaking that mark in its original run.
And it was number one for those 4 years until Titanic came out. So it was the top gross. It was the highest opening weekend of all time at that point. Obviously now with Marvel and everything else and Harry Potter, like, it getting crazy nowadays, but harder in 93.
Yeah. And then it broke that record, you know, the $1 billion record in 2013 when it went back into theaters for its 20th anniversary. And then it had a 30th anniversary re-release that like tacked on a little extra, almost two mil there. So yeah, it's also the highest grossing series of all time at $6 billion worldwide. And that's, I mean, that's kind of like, I think that's a 2023 number, but doubt it's been surpassed very quickly. But yeah, it's a very successful, very popular film, obviously. And it shows. It shows in how great it was.
It's interesting that there was such a relatively small budget just because of all the other departments and people working on producing the film. It's like an all-star team with like Stan Winston and his animatronics.
Yep.
And he's been well-known for Aliens, Terminator, The Thing, with his visual effects, Phil Tippett with his stop motion, Starship Troopers, RoboCop, and then ILM helping out with that too. So it's every top of their craft person helping out making this thing. So I'm not surprised that it made $1 billion, but it looks like it's impressive with the crew
that's on board, especially because actually Phil Tippett ended up not getting tapped to do the go motion. So like, they had done a bunch of test runs with it, ended up not doing it because ILM came in and said, I think we can do this, you know, a computer generated model of this that will be better for these scenes, like these chase scenes where the T-Rex especially is moving so much. And those go motion tests had not been going well. And so basically Spielberg like told him to prove it and was like, okay, prove it to me, you know, that you can do it. Came in and they ILM proved to him that he could do it. And he turns to Phil Tippett and says, I guess you're out of a job. And he says, don't you mean extinct? And that's how that interchange gets into the movie between Malcolm and Grant, because yeah, he was out of a job. But what was interesting is they didn't fire him off the film. He stayed on as the dinosaur supervisor, and his animatronic team was retrained to help support the ILM team. So it's wild that they had whatever, that many people involved.
All these decisions that they made, thank goodness they did, because the balance of like practical versus digital in here, they use it sparingly, but the use of animatronics and all these different things, just even watching it today, there's a couple shots where I'm like, okay, that isn't perfect, but it's still like 90%.
It holds
perfect.
Up very well. Yeah. I had that note as well several times of like, this shot is still really good, still really solid for sure.
Yeah, I think they used something but like 63 digital effects across the entire film, which might sound like a lot, but for the record, Avengers Endgame had over 2,500 digital effects. Yeah. So put that in perspective of everything you see here, with a few exceptions, is all practical, which just to do practical, people.
And they had paleontologists on board, which may sound, again, kind of obvious, but I think not everyone takes such care to be as accurate as possible. And there are definitely, we'll get into it later because I got a whole list for y'all, of things that are not accurate, like from a scientific perspective. But on the whole, that was a part of the process, and that feedback was welcome and taken into account throughout of, is this how they would move? Is this how they would act? Is this, you know, things like that. And they tried to like kind of play in that sandbox pretty well, which I think is awesome. All right. Well, let's get into the whole shebang. So this thing, as we've said, is really incredible.
I think you're supposed to start with Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Okay. Take two. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Nailed it.
Nailed it. Yeah. So let's like, what is everyone's thoughts? It doesn't open with our main characters. It opens with some people that don't really, you know, reappear in the same way on a recurring basis. You're kind of thrust into the story. It feels like mid story, which I think is kind of cool. What does everybody think about this opening? Shit goes down.
It's, you know, sets the tone, dark, jungle themed, ominous, right? A lot of logos, a lot of helmets, and yeah, it just, the action starts almost immediately. It sets the tone for the whole film.
That's I wrote that down, not the exact thought, but that I forget that it opens on just the trees rustling. Like, that's the first thing you see after the opening credits. And that just, like you said, sets the tone for the amount of tension that you're going to experience over the next 2 hours, which another plus for this film. You guys have heard me complain before about movies that don't need to be as long as they are. 2 hours, 7 minutes. This is fucking perfect. And there's not a wasted minute. So throwing you right into that with that initial shot just sort of adds to, it gives you hints. And I think this is just a master class in a series of how to pace something. With the opening 30 minutes are crazy tight. We're jumping from scene to scene, but I did want to focus really quick on this opening scene because I know we covered cast and crew already, but I want to talk about Mr. Joffrey C. Brown. And this is the guy who gets eaten by the raptor at the very beginning of the film. And in, you know, my like 10-year-old brain, that image is just ingrained and I always felt so bad for him and it's scary and all these things. And I went down a rabbit hole on him to see what else he had done. So he was actually primarily did stunts, and he had been an actor for like 20 or 30 years at this point when he gets this role and has an on-screen role. And he did some acting, mostly stunts, but he did stuff on everything from Scarface to Lethal Weapon to Spider-Man to Smokey and the Bandit. So I just thought that was kind of cool that this guy who I remember scaring the shit out of me as a kid for this little 30-second scene had this long history in the industry. And again, similar to what we said about Attenborough coming back after 14 years and nailing this role, this guy gets this incredible scene that sticks with me anyway.
Yeah, I love the subtle tree rustle opening, and it kind of is a opening of a can of worms. You're like, oof, yeah, what's gonna happen here? Where's this taking me? What's the mystery behind this? I love it. I also really like that you're putting together, obviously, that this is a creature and you don't quite see it. I love that you don't quite see it. You can see, like you said, logos, and you can see that there's a lot of gear. And I remember thinking the set is still so legit, like holds up really well. But you can't quite see what she is. You just see that she is some kind of threat. And he's like, I want the tasers charged to 100%. And I was like, tasers? We're sticking with tasers? Like, that's the best we've got. And I just remember being like, and this is different, of course, because you know where it's going, but you're still like, we think tasers are sufficient for this shit. It was just hilarious to me. I was like, I now remember how woefully unprepared for shit to go awry the people at this park are. Mm-hmm. And I like the grabbing of the guy where, you know, he's getting grabbed by her. And they're trying to pull him out. And then the slow hand shot of like he slips and all of that. But I felt so strongly. I was like, why has nobody mercy killed this guy? Like he's about to get tortured and like eaten alive, like Hunger Games style. Somebody shoot him. You know what I mean? Like you're not getting him back. Somebody shoot the poor man. And yeah, nobody does.
I feel like then you'd go to hell. I don't want that on my conscience.
Hey, we'll mercy kill is different.
Yeah. Maybe he was saying, shoot her.
Nobody shot.
And nobody shot. Everybody's gun shy. You're like, no, if there's any time to use the gun, guys, it's now. It feels like it's now. Yeah. That was wild to me.
I liked how you said about seeing the eyes of the creature, not knowing. I mean, we know what it is. We know it's called Jurassic Park, but this movie is just this really, it's like watching a magic show. It's like you're seeing these elaborate setups followed by teases, followed by reveals. And that's watching this time, I paid attention to that, of how little lines of dialogue in the beginning, eventually they're foreshadowing how the dinosaurs are going to behave when we finally see them. We see those trees rustle in the beginning, and that leads to when they get into the actual raptor cage. Like, this is just such a great, and part of it's due to the subject matter. When you're dealing with dinosaurs and no one's ever seen dinosaurs on the big screen to this quality and extent. You have a lot to play with, but just watch, it's like every 15 minutes you have a holy shit moment of something really cool happening that was teased earlier in the film.
100%. I think, you know, you have a lot of foreshadowing here, and there's a lot of just talking about what can happen. I mean, I love the debate that kind of goes throughout the film, to be honest. Like, you have a couple concentrated moments of this debate, but even mid, like, shit has already gone down, you're still having Ellie Sattler trying to, like, explain to Hammond that this is still wildly dangerous, isn't it? You know, like, and it's crazy that you're in the thick of it and it's still fucking going down. You're still having to, like, make this case. And yeah, I think it's really interesting how that is a through line. I think we also have to talk about our introduction to Dr. Grant and Dr. Sattler. I love that we take ourselves out of Jurassic Park for a second. You get on this other dig and you get to see them in kind of their comfort zone and their wheelhouse. And I think it really sets the tone for their personas, their personalities throughout the film as well. And I love that Dr. Grant is such a Luddite, but he's also like sets off an EMP basically everywhere that he goes. And so it just feels early on like he's going to be in direct conflict with all the technology in this park from second one, even though this is, you know, his area of expertise. And I think that's really interesting that they put him kind of almost at odds with it, maybe unintentionally, but that was definitely my read of like, oof, this is, he's, I forgot that he's like the anti-progress, anti-tech, anti-technology.
How much of that
guy
is just job security though? I feel like,
oh, for sure.
You know, at some
for
point
sure.
He throws
it comes
the ball
up later.
He's like, I'm fucking useless now. I'm out of a job.
Right. He's like that guy with the x-ray, you know, he's like, in several years, you won't even need to dig. And you just see his face. He's like, what the fuck? Where's the fun in that? Like, I just love him like panicking at that. And I also love how he immediately acts with the kids. Like that kid that's at the dig site who, don't get me wrong, he's a snarky, annoying kid, which is, by the way, a theme here. Like almost all the kids are annoying in their own right. But he just like leans into scaring the shit out of this kid. To this day, it still just cracks me up. And you just see this kid's eyes go wide. And I love that by the end of it, he's like, yeah, okay. You know, like he's like, maybe you should show some respect, you know, for this nature. And I just thought that was like, you just, this is how you handle kids. Like maybe, yeah, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe kids are not the thing for you, my guy. And it goes immediately into their couple conversation. It's just such a funny segue to me. Like I like his subtle funnies, you know.
He was absolutely right in his action.
Granted, and nothing
there's,
wrong.
There's an internet canon, head canon that kid grows up and becomes Chris Pratt's character in the Jurassic World series. He's like, oh yeah, I'll respect him. I'll grow up and be a dinosaur trainer.
I'll show you, mister. And then they share the screen. Like it's something to spoiler, but yeah, they eventually get back together. I actually liked how they kind of invert to what you're saying, Mackenzie, of sort of the teases of the characters we get here. As the movie plays out, it honestly feels like Ellie becomes more of the survivalist badass, whereas Grant ends up taking care of the kiddos throughout most of the film. And I liked how they turned that on its head, because you think he's going to be this hardened action hero, but he's more babysitting throughout the film. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but
I also love the role reversal. And I love that she gets, like, she even calls it out later, because when she's got to go deal with the power, Hammond's like, I should do this. And he's saying, implying it's because he's a guy. And I love that she's like, we can talk about sexism and survival situations later when I get back from doing the damn thing. So fuck off. Like, yeah,
That's the closest they get to putting it right on the nose. But I like how subtle they are for the most part about it. I also love her quote about women inheriting the earth. So, you know.
Yeah. Which if you think about it, not women, but females, at least largely females, inherit the island. So it's another little light moment of foreshadowing as well. But I just love that she also calls them out. She's like, dinosaur eats man, obviously. It's just this natural, logical conclusion that for some reason, no one has come to. Like, you just kind of want to shake them. But I think that kind of brings me to the Dr. Hammond character of, you see why it works, like how he has
coerce so many people into this crazy fucking idea. Because, I mean, objectively, logically, this is a terrible idea for all the reasons they've said. There's 65 million years of evolution separating man and dinosaurs. Like, they are not meant to be in the same place at the same time. This is a really bad plan. But the way that he presents it and simplifies it, oversimplifies it, I would say, but simplifies it for them, and that he seems really genuinely passionate about the animals and the science and all of that, that you're kind of like, I can kind of see how he got them. But at the same time, he also feels like a snake oil salesman to me.
Yeah, and he's a great salesman.
Yeah. For sure. But he feels like, he says that thing about the flea circus, you know, putting on a flea circus, and how he doesn't want to only ever give a flea circus. And I love that Dr. Sattler is like, it's still a flea circus. Like, you're still selling a flea circus. You're still a snake oil salesman. Like, this is not the same thing. And you're just telling yourself that it is. And I think big part of that is he's selling himself. And it's a big part of why he has such blinders on, that this is perfectly fine. This is a perfectly reasonable measure to take, you know?
I mean, for the record, though, I would, even after seeing 18 Jurassic Park movies, I would still rather go to Jurassic Park than go to a flea circus. So I think it's better.
Correct. My toxic trait is that when Jurassic Park actually opens, I will be buying the ticket and going.
Won't even hesitate. I'm on the first chopper.
I won't wait for the coupon day.
Keep a Coke can. It's buy one, get one free.
Oh, yeah. My God. I love Gennaro. Well, yeah, we'll have a coupon day. Like, people will come on coupon day. Yeah, no, I will not come on coupon day or regular day. I do not want to get eaten by a dinosaur personally, but I respect the effort and the science, and listen, if this was possible, like, the science would be very cool. It's just not, like, for a number of reasons, but it's very cool conceptually that it could happen. I also just think it is wildly irresponsible, because again, and this is something that Dr. Malcolm says later too, which I love, where he's like, the lack of humility and hubris in this room, like, with respect for the power that you have yielded, mm-hmm. is astonishing, you know? And he gives this incredible monologue that I think is so on the fucking money. You know, about, like, you started packaging and branding this and selling it before you even knew what you had. You're not prepared to do this. And
yeah, it's like, you haven't invested in the actual scientific method of how this is supposed to work. You just think it worked one time, so let's launch it.
Yeah. He's like, the lack of humility before nature is wild to me. You had no discipline getting here. You took no responsibility. You just stood on the shoulders of people who came before you, who understood the science better too.
But now I'm gonna go over here and try to fuck this guy's girlfriend. Thanks for coming to my TED talk.
But like, are we surprised? Because he's all like, chaos theory. He's like, it's gonna happen. Like, whatever. I mean, I'm astonished, and you guys are all idiots. But also, I mean, fuck it, I'm here. And so let me get laid before I go out, I guess. I love his line about, I always have my eye out for a future ex Mrs. Malcolm.
Malcolm's penis finds a way.
Listen. Oh, no. If we were in these circumstances and I was not taken like Dr. Sattler, like, would it be an option? Absolutely, it would be an option. But, you know, shit goes down and we don't ever get to see that play out, which I think is really one of the few marks against this film. Like,
I don't think it's unintentional that there's a scene where they find the dino eggs in the wild and, like, the little baby footprints, and then it cuts immediately after to a shot of shirtless Jeff Goldblum. I think that is, like, a subtle message.
Oh,
is it subtle?
Yes.
Is it subtle?
It's extremely subtle.
Or is it incepted. Just? Yeah. And it cuts right to him. Life will find a way, as they said, for sure. But yeah, that's his Burt Reynolds moment, Lamar. You know, and it works. It worked. Like, he is such eye candy in that moment. It is so hilarious to me. It's so intentional and just overt. And you're just like, okay, this is happening.
We need to see if there was another baby boom 9 months after Jurassic Park's opening. Maybe it was the second wave.
Listen, it's inspiration, you know? Why not? Get you some. But I think that's, I mean, you called out there, Lamar, the eggs, right? Like, that the life will find a way hypothesis ends up being 100% accurate, but it is also of their own doing. And I think that's the part that's so
you know, important to acknowledge is that it's the frog DNA, it's the amphibian DNA that lets them change. And like, nobody thought of that. You have some of the best scientists in the world, and you were like, let me grab a fucking frog and fill in the blanks in this DNA strand. That feels like the move. Like, I was so annoyed at that. But also, you know, they did it to themselves. They did it to themselves.
It's just a rush job. If they had one more year of development, then everything would have been fine.
I feel like Matt's an early investor in Jurassic Park. Yeah, I think it all comes back to, you know, Hammond's hubris and his arrogance of the way he's evaluated this ecosystem. I love that she actually says that at one point, Dr. Sattler. I can't remember exactly how she says it, but she's like, why do you think that you can manage this ecosystem of all these extinct creatures? Like, you have extinct and carnivorous plants in the room that will defend themselves if necessary. Like, they are not passive. They're not just pretty, you know? And I love that that is just continually called out. And it's like, this is just another example of like idiot billionaires getting into shit that they shouldn't because of their egos. And like, space race anyone? Like, let's get them out of these kinds of science forward decision making and put the scientists, the educated people, the experts in charge. And you can just tell that like, that's just not what happened here. He's forcing everybody's hand. You know, he's like, you guys figure this out. You figure out a way to make this work.
I feel like based on your speech just now, this and Biodome would be a great double feature back to back. Like, they learn their lesson and they're like, we have to care for this environment to sustain it. But in Jurassic Park, they never do. They just keep repeating.
They don't learn. And they like, they don't learn the lesson. They never learn the lesson. And I just don't understand. Like, again, because it is the through line of the fucking film that it has talked about over and over and over of what a bad idea this is and how it has no respect for nature and how this, and then, even if it wasn't just discussed ad nauseum, it is shown to you in real time that it will go awry and people will die. And they're still just like, fuck it, money. It's crazy. But
the answer to all your questions is money.
Mm. It is. But it's a fun ride. No judgment. It's definitely a fun ride.
There's a you hear about the genetic company, I think it's called Colossal. And they're working on bringing back the woolly mammoth and the thylacine.
What's a thylacine?
The Tasmanian wolf.
Huh.
And the dodo. They're trying to bring back a handful of animals using like genetic CRISPR technology that in the next 10 years, they might actually pull it off.
See, but this is the thing that I like that Dr. Malcolm says that I think resonates here too, is that there's a difference between things that have been made extinct by human involvement and human technology and global warming and things like that versus nature without the interference of man making something go extinct in its own natural processes, right? Like, some of these were not made extinct by man or another predator or a piece of technology or pollution or, you know, whatever, right? Like, they went extinct in their own right without any interference. And those, I think that there should be kind of a healthy respect for that, right? Like, extinction is not atypical in nature. It's a natural process, right? I think the concern is when things are at risk of going extinct when they theoretically shouldn't be, because their environment has been threatened, because pollution is threatening them. And I think there's a distinct difference there. Like, I don't know that we should be trying to bring back the woolly mammoth, right? Like, did that happen naturally, or did that happen as a result of interference from man and overhunting or environmental concerns, things like that? So I think that Dr. Malcolm calls that out. He's like, there's a difference between natural extinction and, you know, unnatural extinction interference.
Is it fair to call it natural extinction when a big fucking rock from outer space hits the planet? That's not really fair. It's not as though, you know, humans, we're extincting ourselves with like emissions and all this, where the climate's eventually going to kill us, right? Like, that is natural. But I think it's unfair
that anything off of Earth is not natural, which I don't think is true.
Not natural to, but I think in the scope of the world these things were living in, I think they were doing just fine.
That's it's a very Earth-centric view, my guy.
Okay with that. You know, put me on. That's my platform. Okay,
Earth. The first. Universe is much larger than just us. Okay.
Make Earth hate again.
Oh my god.
We already got a space force. Fuck.
Oh my god. Don't. Do not get me started. We're going too far the other way. Mark, remove. Hard pass. No, I also I want to talk about the kiddos for a quick sec, because again, while they are annoying in their own ways, I love that Tim is such a fucking nerd and is so fangirling over Dr. Grant and his books, but also kind of like throwing down the gauntlet of this other doctor's book was way longer and thicker and better than yours, but I thought yours was pretty good. You know, it's like he's like giving him this analysis that is kind of harsh, to be honest, but
I think the kids are the right amount of annoying. Like they're right. Just
they're a realistic
right.
Amount of annoying.
Yeah, they're realistic, but they're not overbearing.
Right. Yeah. And they and you know, she gets this little crush on Dr. Grant. The hand, is, I'm like, girl, like that girl is Beret Ave. I would not hold the hand of a grown ass man that I did not know at that age. Like this girl was making moves, y'all. Like I was impressed. Like, okay, respect. I also like that she ends up being the hacker. You know, she ends up coming in hot, like I said, with her computer skills. That is atypical in a lot of these movies, especially in the early 90s. And I love that she gets to be the one to kind of like save the day and figure it out. And
I mean, but it's saved until they realize dinosaurs know how to use Windows too.
Oh my god, I know, crashing. Right?
You're gonna oh, that worked for like 5 seconds.
I know, you're like so relieved, and it lasts 10 seconds, and then you're like, oh my fucking god, we got the doors locked. Oh, glass, there's that bad idea. Yeah, but I love that, but I had such commentary on the software. I was like, this is the weirdest layout of software of Unix is the system she says it is. And I'm like, this is such a weird flow and it's so slow. And I was like, would I have thought this was slow then, or do I just think it's slow now?
I thought it was the most advanced shit I've ever seen. The future is now.
I was very impressed. They both have very solid contributions, to be honest, I think throughout. I also just love them like going to the cafeteria and wrecking shop on the food. I'm like, that is the most realistic thing. Like if I am this kid in this, you know, near death experience situation, but I see that fucking spread, you're damn right I'm gonna go eat some of that. That looked delish. I've never wanted green Jell-O more. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh,
absolutely,
that looks good. That looks delish.
Matt was saying his wife had pitched that as our drink of the day. We could have done green Jell-O shots, but you didn't want to go green again because we just did a green drink for the substance.
Yeah, we're having a little too much green. I'm sorry, but that is a good idea. We could have like added a green Jell-O shot. That would have been fine.
I don't know if it's intentional, but you are, and I know yours is a dinosaur shirt, but you are both wearing green today, so...
Well, I didn't want to outshine my thesaurus. You know, he's here doing the hard work. So can't have a green cocktail as well. Sheesh.
Well, spinning off of what you were saying, Mackenzie, though, I wrote this note on my own and then I was doing research and found that this was actually critiqued. I thought that all the bit players in this, not just our main, say, four people, but when you look at Nedry, when you look at Arnold, everyone plays their parts to a T. I feel like all the side characters are fleshed out despite only getting maybe 10 to 15 minutes of actual screen time. But then I saw that there was criticism. I don't know if it was the initial release where everyone was saying, oh, everyone loves this movie because it's visually stunning, but the characters are kind of one-dimensional and hollow. And then I saw something about how David Koepp, who we've given a lot of compliments, apparently was reading the book. And I guess he was bored when they started talking about their lives off the island and giving them more backstory. He went, I'm cutting all that shit from my movie. Like, let's just focus on the dinosaurs. But yeah. I think it still works out fine. I don't think there's a lack of character in this.
Well, he was quoted as saying, like, when you start seeing them talk more about themselves, you just don't give a shit. Like, and I think that that's true in the context of the actions happening on the screen, right? Like, it is just not going to take precedent when you have... dinosaurs attacking. Like, I'm not here to learn your favorite color right now, bitch. Like, we have shit to do. We have dinosaurs to defend ourselves against, etc. And I agree with you. I think he puts in the right level of detail, like subtle little things, you know, little things about Grant and Sattler and them maybe wanting kids, little things about Dr. Malcolm and his, you know, ex-wives, and, you know, little things about Hammond and his grandkids showing up, right? So he obviously has a relationship with them. Nedry and his salary not being sufficient because clearly he can't manage his money, right? Like, these are just, they give you just enough nuggets to make their interactions with one another make sense. And I think in the context of an action film, like, that's all you need. You just need somebody to make these interplays make sense. But speaking to the production and the shots, like you said, this is beautifully shot. I think, like, you can't ignore that. Again, we already talked about, you know, the animatronics and the digitizing and the special effects and how cool that is. But I also just think you have some of his very classic shots in this film and some really beautiful, like, tension building moments, even in the less action sequence scenes as well. Like, you just have, even in that control room, like, you just feel the sense of tension in that control room, even when nothing's happening, right? Like, there's nothing happening to the kids. Yeah. They're sleeping overnight in the tree. Like, everything's kind of at a lull, and you still feel the tension because of the lighting and the way that it's shot and, like, kind of what you know is coming. You're kind of waiting for that other shoe to drop. And I think, like, he really plays the suspense very well in the way that he has paced it and shot it.
I'm going to repeat myself from earlier. I was not lying when I think this is a perfectly paced film. Even the slower moments when they're in the control room or when Sadler and Hammond are having that heart-to-heart about the flea circus, or when there's the philosophical conversations, they are story beats that are perfectly placed to kind of give you a breather before you go back to being balls to the wall with all the action sequences. So I'm 100% agree with you there.
Thank John F. and Williams for that too. Even in those 100%. Moments, his score for those scenes just keeps something going.
Yeah, I wrote down that, like, three scenes that will just, you look forward to it every time you watch it at this point, even after, you know, 30 years of this movie. The helicopter flight, when it pans up and you see the helicopter flying toward the island for the first time and you get the John Williams score. When you have the Brachiosaurus reveal for the first time, you get that score. And then that entire 5 to 10 minute T-Rex sequence, I would put up against any other piece of cinema of, like, top 10 movie scenes of all time. Just that T-Rex reveal, the eye next to the car with the eyes dilating, roar, that entire sequence is incredible.
And it's, and like you said, the pacing is really strong, even though there's several pauses in the action and you're still in the thick of the scene, you know, like, it's not, oh, I'm actively just tearing at everything to just tear at everything, which is, like, something you could see making sense in this film, but he doesn't make the obvious choice. He makes it more sustained and more complicated, and again builds more suspense because you're just like, I don't know where this is going. I expected him to just come in and wreck shop and destroy everything, right? So your expectation is already upended, and that scene lasts so much longer and is so much more suspenseful and powerful in that way. And I think the same thing is true of the raptor scene. Speaking of scenes you look forward to, the raptor scene in the kitchen is for me, like, one of the best scenes. I love the huff breath, like, subtle stuff, the huff breath on the window into the kitchen is like, oh, like, I literally have it in my notes. I'm like, huff breath. Like, it's just so, you just get hyped. You're like, shit is about to go down, but it's slow. And they move around the kitchen slowly, and the sounds are really well done. And like you said, the score complements it really well. And you have things that could be almost cartoonish, but they're not, right? Like, the raptor running into the reflection on the stainless steel kitchen, like, that could easily, like, not play well and look cartoonish, but the way that it's done and the sound and the pacing and the shot kind of just comes all together. Like, it makes this incredible scene.
Every scene where a dinosaur shows up is, you know, what they mentioned, you don't know what to expect. I love the Nedry scene with the Dilophosaurus when his jeeps gets caught. What's going to happen? He runs into this little thing. Each of the moments where there's a dinosaur on screen, you're like, how will it react? And then all the moments where there isn't one, is one going to pop out at any second?
Yeah.
So that building tension and that constant
on the lookout,
and how is this going to play out? in the moment when they are on screen.
Yeah, I had read that they're dinosaurs. It's a 2-hour and 7-minute film, which we've said. Dinosaurs are actually on screen for 15 minutes. But they're doing such a good job of teasing them, showing you things that they're, the environment being manipulated by them. And even the raptors, you don't actually see them on screen officially, not counting the eye at the very beginning, so like 1 hour and 40 minutes into the film.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But it's like you said, it's all the teasing of it, but it's the subtle teasing, like the, again, the rustling of the trees earlier, the eye through the cage, and just the implication. And Muldoon at multiple points is like, you know, where he's kind of narrating how they hunt for you, and then they're out in the thick of it, so you are literally like watching the periphery, right? You're going like, well, they're gonna come from the sides, and like, and every expectation is kind of upended as you go through it, because they are smart hunters. And I love that they present that, they talk about that in the film, of they're intelligent. They're testing things. They're adapting to you. They're finding ways to hunt you. And it becomes, so then you as an audience are also like, okay, we have to be on the lookout. We are being hunted. Not just, oh, they will pop out. It gives you this, this feeling of being in that. And I think it's really, really well done. I also love, when I'm speaking of favorite shots, I also love the shot, the headshot in the tree with the snake crawling across the branch right in front under the eye. Oh, it's just like chef's kiss. I love it. It's so
Do you
beautiful.
Think the snake is in on it? We know that raptors are very smart. They're strategic. Do you think the snake is part of the team, or is he just like hanging out?
I think the snake is a cheerleader. You know what I mean? The snake is like, you got game, girl. Like, go. Good at respect. Like, I think she's cheering her on. She's like, I couldn't do it. You go do it. You know?
I wanted to, this is sort of going back to your role reversal piece earlier, but in speaking about Muldoon and how, you know, Sadler is kind of the biggest badass in this film.
Oh, yeah,
like Muldoon is, you know, carrying his weight. And I think in the book it goes differently for him, but obviously doesn't here. But I did write down like all the men in this film, or at least like three of the men, are just dressed like they're going out to impress on Friday night. Like Muldoon's wearing his slut era short shorts.
Shorty shorts made my notes as well. I was like, ooh, shorty shorts.
Janelle was like, he's got big, like, was it quads?
Quads,
like,
yeah.
Muscular build there. You got John Hammond all white for Friday night, you know? And then Ian in like Matrix chic, black on black on black. Just, I'm really impressed by the fashion choices of these guys.
Yeah. And I love that, to your point though, really, truly, she's not there for eye candy, right? Like, she's not wearing the sexy clothes. She's wearing like appropriate jungle wear.
Paleontologist
clothes. And she is digging her fucking hands into, you know, trike droppings. And she's like, she's just not there to fuck around. Right, she's there to learn, to do the thing, to help with it, to save the people, and she's got no fucking shame or fear about it. And I just love it. I agree. I totally agree. She's the number one badass in this, and I love that that was upended in this. You wouldn't have expected that. I think you kind of could expect that with Dr. Grant, but the other people on board, you're like, somebody else is going to be the badass, especially Muldoon. You know, you're like, he's going to be the badass. But instead, she's like, I'm going to go out. And he's like, okay, I'll come with you. Okay, fine.
One thing that I wrote down was, I do enjoy the humor in this a lot. I always forget just how, and I know Spielberg didn't write this, but I think he's always drawn to scripts where like, there are these moments of levity, and it's just a pitch perfect adventure film where you have action sequences, you have scary horror-esque sequences, you have comedy sequences, and they kind of break it up. I do, for the most part, like the comedy in this. I like the line about Pirates of the Caribbean and like, they don't eat the tourists if the ride's shut down at Disney.
I love that line. He's like, what? All theme parks have these things. He's like, for real? For real, Hammond? You're making that comparison?
Yeah. Or when the ride is stunned. I love that disappointment. Even we as the viewers, you know, watching it the first time of them on the tour, and you want to see the dinosaurs, and we don't get to see the dinosaurs that first time. He says, there will eventually be dinosaurs on the dinosaur tour. Yes. He's like, I really hate that, man. Like, there's some great stuff. I will flip it, though, and say there are moments where I think Marvel took a page out of this book, where they're like, anytime there's a heavy moment, we need to add a one-liner of levity to take away from that. And I think Malcolm falls into that trap a couple times. You know, they get chased by the T-Rex and it's this very intense scene and he's plays it off with like, oh, you think they'll have that on the tour? Like, I don't necessarily need a couple of those back half of the film comedy bits, but I don't think it detracts majorly. It was just like, I have to find something to ding a little bit, you know?
I feel like it's very character appropriate, though, to be fair. Like, it doesn't feel like just an action movie one-liner, which I think is very typical and fair, but it does feel like something he would say. Like, this is what he brings to the table. And I love Hammond says it at the beginning. He's like, I brought scientists and you brought a rock star. Like, this guy is trying to be the center of attention at all times and have a real persona. So for me, those kind of definitely check out. For sure. And I love them getting upset at the tour. Like, I just think that's so, I was like, this is like every zoo ever. This is like every theme park ever. Like, the animals are not where you want them to be when you want to see them. People are going to leave pissed and want refunds and all this stuff. But one of my favorite parts of the tour is the Mr. DNA shtick. Like, that kind of stuff, like, I am such a nerd. I love the little, like, what's the animated educational video that we're going to watch? Like, if this was real life, like, that's where I would be in Jurassic Park.
You would have paid for the Magic School Bus rights and gotten that in there and had Ms. Frizzle explain what's going on.
For sure. Like, she does it so well. Why not? But I also love Mr. DNA. Can we all agree that Mr. DNA and the Microsoft paperclip, paperclip are the same person, the same animation in different iterations? I'm telling you, like, they're the same. They are the child of the same brain. I'm telling you. I was like, oh, look, it's Clippy. He's so cute, though. I love it. I would listen to him talk to me all day. He's got this charming little southern accent.
I wonder if they, you know, in active moments, they have the same dialogue where Mr. DNA pops in and says, it looks like you're trying to make a dinosaur. Click here.
Click here to cancel. Okay.
Or did you want to write a resume? Maybe they're like partners on the same software at this point in Jurassic Park world.
Microsoft Office should just bring them back. I think it's, you know, it doesn't work half the time anyway. Mr. DNA has got to be able to help us out. I'm convinced. Well, speaking of nerd shit and my affinity for nerd shit, I do want to talk about a couple of things that are, I think, worth noting, that are like fundamental issues. And I'd be really interested to hear, Matt, what you think, because you're like, there's subreddits and there's fanfic and there's like theories about all of this. And if you think I didn't go down that rabbit hole, I did. But
you said you didn't read any of the fanfics.
I didn't read fanfics. I went down the like Reddit rabbit holes, not fanfics. I don't read fanfics. I'm too PG for that. No, I'm just kidding. But I think the number one thing that cracks me up about this is that there's this, the dinosaurs in the park are mostly not from the Jurassic period. So there's only two that are actually from the Jurassic period. And most of them are actually from the Cretaceous period much later. And I think that's how we get to the warm-blooded versus cold-blooded conversation with the Brachiosaurus, where they're saying, oh, he's definitely warm-blooded. He's definitely warm-blooded. And that feels like an interesting thing for him to say in this context. Because I was kind of like, well, yes, that's been sort of proven, so to speak, because during the Cretaceous period, especially like when Tasmania and Australia were together, they're all one landmass, there was so much cold, cold wind that cold-blooded creatures could not have survived. So like Brachiosaurus could not have survived if he wasn't warm-blooded. But I want to know, like, what was the thing that Brachiosaurus is doing right there that he's like, this one's obviously warm-blooded? Like, how is that the clue in that moment for him?
That's a great question, and I don't have the answer.
What? Matt, you're supposed to be my Jurassic Park guru here. Yeah, I don't know. That just really bugged me, because I was like, there's nothing, you know? It's not cold here. We're not, like, there's nothing happening here that's telling me that this creature is warm-blooded, at least for me. I was not connecting the dots. I was like, I don't get it.
Maybe cold-blooded animals don't get colds. That's my theory. I'm throwing it out there because the one sneezes, right? So
the sneeze hadn't happened yet, Lamar, or I would roll with that. I would roll with that.
You know, at the end of the day, they engineered them that way. That's my throwaway line.
They engineered them that way.
Like, Jurassic Cretaceous, that was a Crichton decision, right? Like, he just liked the name better. He was like, Jurassic Park sounds better than Cretaceous Park.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh. Well, and but I think that says a lot again about the planning of this park, right? Like, you're bringing dinosaurs that didn't even live in the same period together into one place. Like, shit's gonna go awry, you know? But yeah,
they have a great marketing team. So,
but they have a great marketing team. So obviously they're gonna make money. So that's all that matters. Fun other little facts that I just want to share. These aren't really questions. They're just fun little facts. So the T-Rex, in theory, cannot run like that, especially that fast. They wanted T-Rex to be able to be like a real distinct threat, like especially with the Jeep chase of like, hey, he's got to be able to keep up with the Jeep. So he's got to be able to go almost 60 miles an hour. But T-Rex's bones were hollow and would not have been able to support his weight or that function of movement so quickly at that speed with the pounding of his weight, full body weight on his bones. He would have actually like busted, like his bones would have broken. Mm. So, fun fact.
I also like that he just gives up. Like, fuck this, it's not worth it.
He ran into a tree. That was tough.
Yeah, his hollow bones. He got like a bone bruise and was like, oh, my shin.
Crashed into a tree.
Matt's like, hey, don't talk about T-Rex like that.
He's got three delicious meals in that truck and he's just like, oh, that's too far.
It's true. He was like, you know what? This is too much work. I'm gonna go elsewhere. He also had binocular vision. He did not have movement only vision in theory. So more like the bird of prey theory is actually more accurate. And that is referenced throughout that they evolved into birds. Mm-hmm. And that is the way that birds of prey, how their vision works, where you're like, you know, you put binoculars on and you get this like singular view. So that's kind of what he has, where it creates almost a 360 view of your surroundings, not movement only. So that whole premise of like, if they just didn't move, he wouldn't see them. That wouldn't have worked with the real T-Rex. So big miss in my view, but fun one that I think is cool production related. So the Velociraptor, as you know, is a big deal in this one. And he was actually quite a bit smaller IRL, the Velociraptor. They made him bigger, much bigger for production so that he could also, they had to like differentiate the dinosaurs too. That's the other thing. There's several dinosaur things that are just wrong because they didn't want their sizes to be so comparable. They wanted you to be able to tell which one's which. So Velociraptor is quite a bit bigger than in real life. However, after this film was made, they discovered the Utah Raptor, who is a much bigger raptor. And the running joke on there was that they made it for the film and then it was discovered. So they were like, you're welcome. We discovered this raptor, but also was maybe covered with feathers. So again, the bird thing is like a really cool running, possibly very true theory, and makes an appearance in the later Jurassic World where they have the little feathers on their head, the like little mohawk feathers. That's because of that.
Matt, do you think they should go, you know how in like Star Wars, George Lucas went back and added like the ghosts of that guy that played Anakin and like fucked with all the originals? Do you think they should do that for Jurassic Park and add feathers to all the dinosaurs?
Oh my God.
CGI?
No.
I'm a purist, so I would say no. Yeah. Leave it
they
alone.
Engineered them that way to not have feathers.
That's your answer to everything. They engineered them.
He's like, listen, there's a reason for everything in Jurassic Park. I'm an early investor, okay? Let me explain.
I also want to know, flipping off of what you said, Mackenzie, about the vision of the T-Rex, is the inverse true, where can no one see the T-Rex if he's not moving? Because how the fuck else does he sneak into the building at the end to save them from the raptors? He just there.
Busts right in.
My running theory is if he's not moving, you can't see him.
You can't see him.
The reverse is true. Yeah.
I have to tell y'all, that shot is just one of the where the ribbon comes down. And I'll share it in the post or maybe with y'all in a text later, Matt. I saw this movie. The best way to see this movie is at Red Rocks in Colorado. Ooh. And they showed this film in Red Rocks and they had actually just gotten a brand new screen. It is the best movie experience I think I have ever had in my life. And that shot is the most incredible thing you will ever see. And I have incredible pictures of it. I'll have to send it to y'all. But it's like, it was mind blowing. I was like, I'm ruined for watching this movie any other way. And you're in the rocks and you get this huge fucking T-Rex on the screen. It was the coolest thing I think I've ever seen. It was incredible.
Sounds amazing. I'm a little jealous.
I'll send you the picture, and I have a couple little videos, but they do that. It's movies on the rocks at Red Rocks every summer. Yeah. If you ever now,
that's another
make a visit.
Matt, correct me if I'm wrong. That's another thing that they changed for the ending. Like the T-Rex doesn't show up to kind of save our heroes, right? In the book,
no, that scene doesn't happen. And in the early drafts of the film, it was just going to be Grant like blowing them up with grenades or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. They did such a great job with the animatronics that could that be right? That they were just compelled to get T-Rex back.
I think that's what it was. They were like, T-Rex needs more of a big moment, a big scene. And I think that's why they like wrote that in.
I heard that, but then I also, and this could be conflicting, you know, people on set, but I heard that that last scene of the T-Rex is the one part where it is completely digital. There is no animatronic in that scene, which I think is why it's, you know, when I said earlier that there's like 5% of the shots where it's like, oh, this doesn't age as well as the rest. I think it's that one where it's nearly all digital in that sequence.
I think it works so well, though. I mean, it's so well done. I think it's, you know, and with the raptors, too, like they just I think it balances really well. And that whole fight scene, like I love that the fight scene becomes between them, you know, and they get sneak out. I just think, I think it's such a cool shot.
Yeah.
Okay. Two more nerdy nuggets and we can move on. So Loy extractions, do y'all remember during Mr. DNA conversation where they're explaining how they do Loy extractions to get the DNA? Because they're like trying, the scientists are all trying to figure out how they did this. And they're like, did they do these Loy extractions, which, fun fact, if you didn't know, are digging into fossilized bones and trying to extract the DNA from there. But the problem is that they're usually exposed to some kind of element. So the DNA is damaged and exposed over time. But this is why he's funding a dig in Montana, because his premise is that those northern dig sites would have better preserved bones, that the Loy extraction would work better from there. It ended up not being the play, but he had digs all over the place. And the reason was that they felt that those winter months would preserve those bones better and that the DNA would not have disintegrated quite as much, which is literally impossible because DNA has a half-life of 521 years, in case you were curious.
Whoops.
So bad premise, Hammond. Just saying.
Well, maybe they just engineered it to be that way.
Is that, or they
using that joke?
I don't know if you used it right. I'm going to be honest. I'll defer to Matt. Well, it's like his explanation. I always
say, when in Rome.
Anyway, I'm done with the nerd facts. But those are interesting things that came up for me while watching it this time. I was like, ooh, this is fascinating. And
cool. Do you guys have a favorite? We talked about, and I have a few options here, but like the most tense scenes. And are there any that we haven't talked about? Because I feel like there's a few other little sequences that get your heart racing. But any other favorites that stand out?
The scene where Ellie is powering up the park again and she's in that electrical room, doesn't know where Arnold is, Ray Arnold, Samuel Jackson, and she's navigating and not knowing which way to go. And there's just that intensity.
Even that run in where the camera's tracking her from behind, and you feel like she's being pursued, but then she gets in and then, sorry, continue.
I'm trying to remember what I had read about Samuel Jackson and his time on, in the film, because his death happens off screen. And I remember reading that he spent the least amount of time out of the whole cast. I don't think he actually ever made it to Hawaii for shooting. And whatever scene they were going to have him in where he dies, it's cut off screen, but it's just Ellie powering up and the guy, the kids and Alan are climbing the fence at the same time. That's a pretty intense moment, I think.
Yeah, it turns out Alan likes kids more than Ellie, because Ellie electrocutes poor little Timmy.
Again, with that role reversal, you know, like, but no, it is so tense. You're like, oh shit, she's going to get to the button. And even though, you know, again, having seen this multiple times, what's coming, you're still just like, ah, just go a little slower, you know, or whatever, or go a little faster crawling over. I think that scene is really good. And I love her commitment, to your point, Lamar, to the fucking run. He's like, you run, get to that room. And she knows.
Doesn't,
like,
look back. Just go.
And I think she kind of knows too, that he's essentially sacrificing himself, because if they are surrounded, like, what else is going to happen? He's going to die, but he's protecting her. And I think she takes that super seriously, and she doesn't fuck around with it. She's like, I know what he's doing for me so that we can save these people, and I got to fucking go. And again, she just keeps being the hero. She just keeps committing to the bit, and I love it.
Yeah, not to backtrack too far, but I do have an answer to that, Matt, when you were talking about Sam Jackson. So there was a hurricane in Hawaii. He was supposed to be flying in to film that sequence, and a Hurricane Inika, I think it was called, hit the island. And not only did it prevent him from flying, but it destroyed some of the set pieces that they had. So he was never able to film that. And he actually, the actor, is on, you know, on the record as saying, I'm kind of disappointed. Like, I wanted it to happen on screen, but I kind of, this leaves it open where he could come back with a robot arm in Jurassic World 8 or something.
I can't wait.
Yeah, same, because he only makes it better, let's be honest. Another scene that I really think builds a lot of tension but also kind of frustrates me is the car falling through the tree scene.
Yeah.
And that one is very tense and you're very concerned, but I'm also like, climb around. Like, stop jumping down below the car that is falling on top of you. There are other branches. Climb the fuck around. This is, and this is like a, this is an action movie thing. I know it's literally a trope. It exists for a reason. We're creating tension, blah, blah, blah. But all I can think is like, this is the same thing like when a car is chasing you in a film and you don't run to the right, you know? I'm like, get out of the way. And also, you're teaching this kid real bad habits. Now this kid, if he's ever, you know, got a car after him again, he's just going to keep running right in front of it. And then it plops on top of him.
No, yeah, they end up getting crushed anyway. And thank God there's the little hole in the actual body of the car.
I love that the kid's like, well, we're back in the car. Like, that part is cute and funny. But the whole time I'm just annoyed. I'm like, crawl around. I want to like shake the screen for those kinds of scenes. But it's still, again, it's effective suspense building for sure. But I think like when we come to the end of all of this, like, we've had all this great action that's paced so well. The music is done so well. The effects are done so well. We get to what I feel is kind of, I mean, I love it. I think it's really well done and it opens the door to a lot, obviously, but the ending is pretty anticlimactic. You know, you do get to this moment where they just fucking peace out. They're just like, we're getting the fuck out of here, which, don't get me wrong, like, you're going to get the fuck out of there. I'm not saying that that's wrong. Of course they will, but there's just no other denouement. You're just like, they're just gone. And they're done with that shit. And the perception could very easily be like, we're just going to let them die off on the island and we're all done with this. And there's no accountability either. Like, nobody's getting into trouble. Hammond's not getting in any kind of trouble for having done this and all these people dying. Like, you don't get any of that.
I'll let Matt explain the book ending because I know that's different and I don't know all the details. But I just wanted to say, I'm sure there's a world where they make a version of the end of this film where the final thing is the T-Rex kills the raptors and then chases them to the helicopter and they escape in the nick of time. And that's sort of the climax. But I think Spielberg wanted the T-Rex to end up being seen as a hero in this just because of how, I guess, attached he got over the course of making this and seeing it on screen. But Matt, I know that the book ends a bit differently, right?
It ends a bit differently. There's a few other deaths. Should I spoil those? Is that okay? Are you going to go read the novel?
I probably not. I mean, I've had it in the back of my mind for years and I still haven't read it. So I think go for it.
I think Hammond, he gets eaten by the little compies that are in the second movie.
If anybody deserves to die, it's kind of Hammond, right? Yeah.
Like, karma? It's deaf Hammond, yeah.
And then Malcolm, he dies from his injuries. And they might, I guess they retcon it in the second book and say that he recovers, but they get off the island in the novel. And then Costa Rica says, you know what, this is a hazard and it's a problem. And they just napalm the island.
Which, like, okay, cool. That's great. Like, that makes sense. But I see why they maybe didn't include it though, because you're like, I mean, again, it kind of just doesn't wrap up the story in the same way. At least this, they're like flying off into the sunset and it's a more romantic ending in that way. So I get it. Mm-hmm. Well, I think all that to say, this is a awesome fucking movie and it just really holds up.
110%. You are forgetting the last shot though, where they're in the helicopter and he sees the little like pelican flying outside.
Yeah.
It kind of cuts to him and he smiles. And like, what do you guys read into that?
Dinosaurs are always with us because they're birds.
I think he's like, these are the new dinosaurs. Yeah, exactly.
It as he sees the pelican and he realizes Jurassic Park is not going to work because they've been extinct. But he thinks of another idea, which is Bird World. And he's smiling because now he has this great business idea. And that's why he's not in the second movie. He comes back because Bird World fails while that's happening. Then he comes back in the third one. That's my theory. Thoughts?
Sure. Sure. Makes total sense.
Thank you.
You might be right.
I'm looking for investors. Bird World.
Matt's in, as we've established. Matt's ready to buy for sure. Well, so we, what's our rating on this? What is, how does everybody feel about this?
You know, no pressure. Biased. So, 1 to 10, right?
My, yes. 1 to 10. Yeah.
10 is the perfection. Perfect film. It's perfect. Yeah. And I don't think I can give any film a 10.
Same.
There are things in this film, a couple handful of lines of dialogue that I don't particularly love. Some technical things that are not well hidden, like the cables in the trees when the truck is falling.
Mm-hmm.
Couple other smaller things, but I mean, geez, I'm going to give it a 9 because I don't know what more you could do to make it better. That's just for me. It's a 9 for me. Maybe it's an 8.5 if it's a little less generous, but it's my all time. So,
well, I appreciate like the balance of subjectivity and objectivity, because I think it's possible to say this is my favorite movie of all time, or this is one of my favorite movies of all time, but to know that it's not perfect, because I think it's two different things of like personal opinion versus quality of film or filmmaking. So for me, I think, what did I give The Sandlot, Mackenzie? Like a 9.8? I was like, there were these two, like, little things.
Like,
I didn't
9.9, 9.8, yeah.
So I think for me, it's probably going to be, yeah, a 9. I think Jurassic Park is damn near perfect. There's a couple things that I would change. And I'm not going to dock it any points at all for being 30 years old and two of the effects not holding up as well as the rest of the film. Because I think for when it's made, it is just incredibly, not even ahead of its time, but just like it's, I said,
innovative.
Before.
But,
yeah,
but innovative. It is. It, the impact it's had on sci-fi, fantasy, all films, really.
Yeah, all films, for know? Sure.
Yeah, so I can't give it a perfect 10, but I will say I think this is the best adventure film ever made. Like, I think it is number one as far as, you got some action elements, you have some horror elements. Could the character be a little more fleshed out? Sure, but I think that you don't necessarily need that with how tight of a runtime this is. So yeah, I'd go like solid 9.
Well, I don't like to do the same thing as everybody else usually, but I will say I'm probably a solid 9 as well. I think it is a masterclass in collaboration and final product in filmmaking. The score, the effects, the animatronics, the digitization, the acting, the writing, the way that it has come together with very, very minor flaws, to your point, Matt, like just some really small, subtle ones. Yeah, I don't know what else you could ask for it, in especially an action film that has, you know, a lot of action films have no right to be that good, right? Like, they're most of the time just, it's just here to entertain. This is just entertaining and beautiful and well fleshed out and artistic, and it tells a story and it opens a door and it touches on science and just really wraps the genre, I think, in a bow, in a way that, you know, other action films don't. So yeah, just mostly because I can't give anything a 10 either. And I do think there are some minor flaws. Yeah, I think it's a solid 9 for sure.
Yeah. You mentioned the digital effects, and the last fun fact I wanted to throw out today is that George Lucas came on to monitor post-production of this film. And through seeing the footage, that's when he realized, oh, the technology exists now that I want it in order to make the Star Wars prequels. So for all you Jar Jar Binks fans out there, you can thank Jurassic Park.
It's funny you say that. I thought of Jar Jar during the...
When did that happen?
The herd, when the T-Rex is chasing the herd, and you look even at their skin, like the aesthetic is very similar to Jar Jar's skin and like the sheen on it a little bit. And I actually...
You're saying George Lucas ripped this off? I can see
Gallimimus.
100%.
Gallimimus.
Gallimimus, exactly. And their skin and like the sheen, I was like, I see it. I see it. Popped in my head immediately. So yeah. He stole it. He must have stolen it.
I had read that it also motivated Peter Jackson to work on Lord of the Rings because of the CGI advancements. So, like, for better or for worse, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, massively influential film. Groundbreaking in a lot of ways.
That's the word I was looking for before. Okay, I'm going to write that one down. Groundbreaking.
Groundbreaking.
I'll use that on whatever we do next
week. I'll spell it for you later. Don't worry.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you for coming and lending your expertise on all things Jurassic Park. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for letting us pepper you with questions about it.
Thank you for having me on. I had a fun time.
And thanks for reading books.
Sure. And taking the load off of me. You know, I'm always the one who had to read the book. So I appreciate you coming in.
My pleasure. Awesome.
Well, thank you all for joining, fam. We appreciate you. Come back next week for our next Spielberg. Very different vibe, again, speaking to his range. Catch me if you can. And
little Leo
action. Yeah, maybe it's going to be a good time. But in the meantime.
Yeah, follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, Instagram, TikTok. You can also watch video of the episodes now on YouTube or Spotify, but feel free to interact with us, engage, send us some messages, give us ideas for future movies, all that good stuff.
All that good stuff. All right. For now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers. One and a half ounces of tequila, 0.75 ounces of Aperol, 0.5 each of lemon, lime, and strawberry puree, and then a little extra simple to sweeten it up. And we are calling this fucking Mark.
Your own cocktail name.
I named this shit.
Tyrannosaurus wrecked, my guy.
Yeah. Okay.